You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Fairman. Thanks for spending your Thanksgiving holiday with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a lot of people have been dusting off their sewing machines since the pandemic has been keeping most of us at home a lot more. We'll talk about the increased interest in sewing in the last decade with a couple of instructors, and they'll give us some great advice for starting or restarting that hobby. First, the American middle class grew and did well in the years following World War II. And there were opportunities for many working people without college degrees to live a middle-class lifestyle. That's gotten harder and harder to do in recent decades. Our next guest set out to find out why, and he says a big part of the story is that we're missing a big part of the story, and that could be the secret to turning things around. Jim Tankersley reports on tax and economics for the New York Times. His recent book is called The Riches of This Land, The Untold True Story of America's Middle Class. Jim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, a key part of your book is this idea that we missed, as we look back in American history, we miss a big part of the story. What are we missing? And I guess more importantly, who are we missing when it comes to the story of the American middle class?
The who is so important to this. We think of the American middle class so often as a country as the sort of leave it to beaver story of white men in ties coming home to houses in the suburbs after World War II. And that's definitely part of the story. But the big thing we missed, which I have discovered in looking through just large amounts of economic data, cutting edge research, and then interviews across my career as an economics reporter, is that the middle class boomed after World War II and for the decades that followed, in large part because we as a country started opening the opportunities of our job market to a much wider group of people than just white men. In particular, women of all races and black men and immigrants surged into jobs that they had not been allowed to do before the war, and in many cases before the civil rights movement. And it was their breaking down those barriers that created actually more economic growth, more opportunity, and the income gains overall that pulled millions of people into the middle class.
I want to stay in that era for a moment. You describe this influx and you share some of the stories of the people who are a part of it, of women coming into these jobs that they couldn't have had before, people of color, and the immigrants you mentioned. The thought, if we think of our economy as a zero-sum game, all those people coming in is going to mean the white men already in those positions would suffer. They wouldn't get as many jobs, or it would decrease their wages. You looked at a lot of economic research of what happened. What did happen?
Well, the opposite of that happened, because it turns out that the job market is not a limited number of jobs. There's actually a vast opportunity to expand the amount of jobs that we have in America. And you know, from 1950 to 1980, nearly 30 million women entered the labor force in the United States, and that basically had no negative impacts whatsoever on the white men who were already in the labor force. They were working just as much, and they experienced big income gains. And there's a reason for that. The reason is that when we allow people to contribute to the economy, either for the first time by pulling them into the labor force, or to a greater degree than they had before by letting, for example, women who had previously been consigned only to be secretaries to now suddenly be lawyers or doctors. When we did that as a country, we created what economists call a productivity boom. Just a lot more economic growth from more people working, plus more growth from the people working in higher value positions. All of that basically has a positive feedback loop. And so when there's more money and more growth flowing through the economy, there can be more job creation, and that can lift essentially all boats across the economy.
And you see with this story of wage stagnation, difficulties faced by people to keep that middle class lifestyle, partly that's because we were reversing that trend. Tell that part of the story, because that's something that doesn't get talked about much.
It's crucially important. I think we are all familiar with many of the changes of the American labor market in the last 40 years that have been really harmful to individual workers. Automation of jobs, outsourcing of jobs. We're aware of that. What hasn't happened, though, is that new and better jobs have not come along to replace the good jobs that went away in so many instances. And I think a big reason for that is that we stopped opening these new doors for the marginalized workers in our country. So you know, the work of the Civil Rights Act, which is arguably the most important piece of economic legislation in the last 100 years, at least in America, that the Civil Rights Act had a big effect for a decade or so. And then the Reagan administration set out to start rolling back some parts of it. It challenged parts of it in court. It went, you know, so far as to launch this war on drugs, which had horrible labor market implications for Black men who ended up incarcerated at much higher rates. And then when the economy changed, the composition of the economy changed to favor women, who are the most educated workers in the country now as among the people entering the labor force. The trends in the economy should have helped them, but our child care policies didn't keep up, and we made it hard for women to juggle the society's demands of them as workers and mothers. And so we've lost a lot of the gains we could have had from women. And so all of those things and more ended up adding up to new barriers to participation for those workers and the loss of what could have been another golden era for the middle class.
We're talking to Jim Tankersley. His new book is The Riches of This Land, The Untold True Story of America's Middle Class. He says the middle class did well when more people were included in it, women, people of color, and it's declining when they're not. Jim, you paint a picture of kind of an us against them mentality with the decline of the middle class. The white middle class views in this situation, maybe, or white middle class men might view women as competition or people of color or immigrants. And you make the case that so many things are in common among those groups. Talk about that.
I think it's one of the great tragedies of America that so many workers who have so much to be gained by banding together have instead time and time and time again been turned against each other by the powerful, let's be honest, powerful white men who have run the country since its birth. And I think that one of the real ways we see this is in the just sort of this my job is being taken away discussion. It is true at individual levels that certain people have lost, you know, a job to a person who doesn't look like them. But if you look at across the history of the economy, like we were saying earlier, there's not a finite number of jobs. And the real problem is that the new and better jobs haven't appeared. And so my argument in the book, again, based on all this research, and it's a difficult one, honestly, to tell a worker who feels like, you know, I've lost my job to someone who doesn't look like me. But it's to say, listen, if you trust in the power of an expanding economy with more opportunity for everyone to lift all workers and create jobs, then it actually is better for you. It really, truly will work out better for you and for people like you in the end if everyone has more opportunity. And I think so that can be such a difficult story to tell because you're essentially arguing that jobs are going to appear that people can't exactly pinpoint what they're going to be, but that the more workers we have, the more productivity we have, the better those jobs are going to be. And it's not a put it on a bumper sticker car slogan for a political campaign, but I think it is absolutely the time tested secret formula of middle class prosperity in America.
Let's bring on a caller, and Tom is with us in Cedarburg. Tom, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to mention too, along with what your guest is saying, is that I do believe that the attack on unions in this country, really since the 70s and 80s, has made a huge difference. And the union movement had really grown in 40s, 50s, 60s, and even into the 70s, but it's been attacked since the 80s relentlessly. And that's also one of the main reasons why things are declining.
Tom, thanks for the call. The role of unions in all this, Jim.
Well, you know, unions, my book actually opens with a union organizing moment of Black women in a tobacco factory in Winston-Salem, North Carolina during World War II. And unions played a crucial role as the caller was saying in the expansion of the middle class story after the war. If you go back further in American history, that they were at times exclusionary forces. They held back some workers to protect the workers who were already in the union. But, you know, what we've seen over the last several decades, as the caller notes, is that we've had a decline in unionization. And that's partly because the economy has shifted away from the sectors that are traditionally unionized. Production, manufacturing has been a much more heavily unionized sector than and it has shifted to be less unionized now. But as we shift into services, that has not traditionally been as as unionized. And so one of the arguments that I make in the book is that if you even if you don't have the same historical union rates, what you really need is bargaining power for workers, the ability for them to command to be paid what they're actually worth for the output that they're doing, for the value of their work. And the best way to do that is to have low unemployment and strong economic growth. And that allows workers to basically pick and choose what jobs they're going to do and for what wage. And so if we commit as a country to running those hot labor markets for long amounts of time, and I think that the opening of opportunity is what will get us there, then we can have effects that are similar to, I mean, it's not entirely the same, but similar to the bargaining power benefits that workers and unions enjoyed in that post-war era.
We're talking to New York Times tax and economics reporter Jim Tankersley about his book, The Riches of This Land, The Untold True Story of America's Middle Class. And we want to hear from you. Do you consider yourself to be in the middle class? What does that mean to you? Have you always been there, or did you come from somewhere lower or higher? How do you view the current state of America's middle class? What is the good paying job situation like where you live? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with author and reporter Jim Tankersley about what happened to good-paying middle-class jobs in America. His new book is The Riches of This Land, The Untold True Story of America's Middle Class. And we want to hear from you. Are you or do you know someone who lost a middle-class job in the last few decades? What happened? What did you do next? Are you confident that your kids will be able to achieve and hold on to a middle-class lifestyle? Why or why not? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and share your story. Back to your calls now. Todd is with us in Milwaukee. Todd, hi.
Hi. I'd like to make comments. First of all, my father was definitely a victim of the globalization and the change of a policy in this country in the 1970s. Had a great paying job, could support a family by himself. And then Burkett at Poor Tractor, and that dissolved. And he got screwed out of his pension, and it was terrible. But what I guess the biggest thing I want to comment on is the U.S. Was the only industrialized country in the world post-World War II. We had no competitors. The growth a no-brainer for all those years.
And you're then, breaking up, Todd. Thanks a lot for calling in and for sharing your family story. And I think I see where you're going. And I wonder about this myself, Jim. The U.S. had this unique moment where the rest of the industrial world had been devastated by World War II. We were the only game in town. So maybe it was easy to have this more shared prosperity then as the rest of the world catches up. Naturally, we're not going to have things as good.
Yeah, I hear that a lot. And I think there's certainly validity to the argument that the American experience after World War II was different from what we're going through now. But I also actually think it's why we should focus so much on how long that experience lasted. We are not hopefully going to have another rebuild of Europe after another devastating war for the United States to sell goods into. But we do have this opportunity to do what came after that initial flourish. I mean, it's not just like in the late 40s and the 50s we were surging. We also had the 60s were a really great time economically for the United States. And I think that the reason for that, and again, shown by, you know, this really great economic research from the University of Chicago and from Stanford, is that we opened this opportunity to workers who had been held back, something like 40% of all per worker growth in the United States since 1960 has come from that opening of opportunity. And so we still have much more we can do there. It's true we don't have the same conditions after the war, but it's also true that we have the raw materials in human talent that we had after the war. And so let's, my argument is, let's try to repeat the replicable part of that experience. And if we do, I mean, we're still, we've experienced economic growth in this country for the last 30 years. It just has not been broadly shared in the same way that it was after the war. And so if we can get that sort of secret, that second part of the World War, post-World War II story, the human part of it, unlocked again, well, then I do think we can have that shared prosperity one more time.
Yeah, can you talk about the divergence between economic productivity and what people are getting paid?
Yeah, I mean, it's if you look at it, it's not like the country's economy has not expanded over the last 30 years, 40 years. It's expanded a lot. Even when you adjust for inflation, we've had a lot of growth, and most of it has gone to the richest people in the country. There's just a lot of ways you can cut that data. There's a lot of argument among economists over what exactly is the right way to do it. But it is just true that the economy is not performing for the typical American worker anywhere close to the same way it did in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, or even in the late 1990s. One of the most striking stats that I calculated in the book was that if you look at just how fast a typical American household's incomes were growing in that one burst in the late 90s that looked a lot like the post-war boom, and you say, okay, what if we had had that growth for the whole 21st century instead of the growth we've had now? Well, the typical American household would be earning 50% more today than they actually are. I mean, that's just an enormous gap that shows just how much, especially in the last 20 years, the economy stopped delivering for working people.
We're talking to Jim Tankersley. His book is The Riches of This Land, The Untold True Story of America's Middle Class. Let's bring on another caller now. Rick is with us in Ripon. Rick, hi.
Hi. Jim, I wanted to get your thoughts on why it is that so many of the what we would call trade sectors in our country, electricians, plumbers, welders, roofers, have tens and tens of thousands of open positions, and those industries are starved for workers, and the pay is not minimum wage. These are jobs that in a lot of areas are paying well north of $100,000 a year. I recently saw that auto repair at dealers considered high-tech jobs now, that they're projecting a 30 or 40,000 worker shortage because they cannot get labor for those. So I'm curious, if we bring it down from big macro kind of observations to those opportunities that would be considered robust middle-class opportunities, why aren't we getting interest in them?
Rick, thanks. Jim, what do you think?
Rick, it's a great question, and I love it. And I think there's a really important answer to it, which is that the way we train workers in this country, from the education system through to post high school or post college work training, is broken. We just have sort of a true two-track system where people tend to either think that they are going to try to go through a four-year degree or they don't. And we obviously have a really strong community college system in this country that needs to be a lot stronger. We just need to have much better vocational training, both for young people and for mid-career workers who need to change positions. Other countries have different ways of doing this that are more flexible for workers. But, you know, I really think that we spend way too much time, and I'm a graduate of a four-year college, but I think we spend way too much time talking about the issues with four-year colleges when we think about skills and job preparedness. And we need to be thinking a lot more about two-year colleges, about skills training programs, and about apprenticeships, about the ways to get young people into these, like you said, good-paying tracks, and then to retrain them if for some reason in 20 years we don't need auto mechanics anymore because, you know, we've perfected the art of the robot mechanic or whatnot. We need to have a way to take those really good skills that workers have learned in one industry and figure out how to repurpose them for something else. So I think it is an enormous challenge for our politics right now on every level, the local level, the state level, the federal level. And relative to the size of that challenge, it is so under-discussed and so important.
Rick, thanks for that call. In our last couple minutes, Jim, I'm worried I'm giving people a false impression of your book. We're taking the big view, but your story really starts and ends with people. What happened to the people you went to high school with who had hoped for jobs in the timber industry, and the people you met in the Carolinas and Ohio along the way. Can you give us a sense of some of the human scope of what you report on in your book?
Yeah, I really think that you can't convey complex policy topics and data without really telling stories of humans. And so I start, like I said, I start with this historical example with the story of the women who organized the R.J. Reynolds factory in Winston-Salem. But, you know, this for me, this whole journey that led to this book began when I was in high school. I grew up in Oregon, which is actually where I am right now covering the forest fires. But I grew up in Oregon in a timber town, and I watched the economic ladder snap out from under of all these, mostly guys, but also women I went to high school with whose parents were able to earn a good middle class job in the timber industry or supporting the timber industry. But then when the industry kind of cratered in Oregon in the 80s and 90s, that wasn't available to them anymore. And I really wondered, when was the economy going to start working for folks like that again? And it's just over time. And as I've traveled and lived other places and reported other places, I've realized that's a much bigger story than my high school. And so the story of the American economy is it not delivering for workers who it used to. And so, you know, the main character in the book really is a guy named Ed Green, who was a worker in Winston-Salem and is the sort of guy who used to have a middle class job, had to give it up, and then couldn't find another one after the economy shifted. And so he's had to work two jobs to support his middle-class black family in North Carolina. And, you know, his story and his family's story really animate the book and really is my favorite part of it. Just the experience of getting to know an extraordinary worker and an extraordinary family. I just think is a real, one of the real joys of being a reporter and I hope is reflected in the book and the way that the storytelling goes.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so, so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Jim Tankersley covers tax and economics for the New York Times. We talked to him today about his new book, The Riches of This Land, The Untold True Story of America's Middle Class. Coming up after the news, after a few decades of falling out of favor, sewing is making a comeback, and in a big way. We'll talk with two experts about why it's important to them and find out how to get started making or repairing your own clothes. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Every first Monday of the month, it's time for Mondays with Mike. WPR Director Mike Crane or WPR Director of Content Michael Arnold joins the morning show, the Larry Mueller Show, or Central Time to answer your questions. That's Mondays with Mike here on the Ideas Network. Now, a lot of things have happened in recent history to make sewing fall out of fashion. Many home economics programs in schools were cut. Full-time work for both halves of a couple didn't leave much time to make our own clothing. And these days, it's easy and cheap to buy clothes brand new. But the last 10 years or so, I've seen a comeback to the sewing world, and it seems to be driven in part by young people. And the pandemic has been driving a lot of interest. We want to hear from you. Do you like to sew? Why do you do it? Did you learn it in school from a family member, or did you pick it up on your own? Tell us about a project you've done or are working on right now, and has the pandemic led you to do more sewing? Tweet us at CentralTimeWPR and let us know. Belinda Banicki is the interim program director for the fashion and retail program at UW-Stout. She's also an experienced sewist. Belinda, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And Diane Dine has designed and written many sewing-related books, patterns, and articles for Nancy's Notions and worked closely with the Sewing with Nancy team. She's taught sewing, owned and operated her own fabric store, and worked in the sewing industry for decades. Diane, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, I want to hear both your origin stories, Diane, and let's start with you. When did you first start sewing?
Well, I started sewing in 4-H when I was about 10 years old, and the creativity that it nurtured gave, and the ability to create clothing that was unique and well-made is kind of what you know, attracted me to that. I also got my Bachelor of Science degree in consumer ed at, or consumer science rather, at Stevens Point, UW Stevens Point, and the pattern design and fashion classes, textiles, tailoring, clothing workshops furthered my interest in it. So I was very happy when I was able to use my college education in doing something I loved as I taught consumer science at the high school level, and I had my own store, and I also worked with Nancy Zeman, as you mentioned, doing workshops and lectures around the United States.
And Belinda, how did you first, Belinda, how did you first get into sewing?
Yeah, I started when I was super young. I really wanted to make clothing for my dolls. So my mom taught me how to sew when I was like five. And yeah, I just kind of kept doing it. I really enjoyed it. It's a really great way to be able to kind of physically see something that's in your mind. And it's a fun pastime.
Diane, are you seeing maybe more people either get into sewing or back into sewing over the last few years, and especially in this pandemic year of 2020?
I definitely have seen an increase in sewing during the pandemic. I think the demand for sewing machines and sewing supplies has really been a lot because, you know, people that are wanting to sew for this, I think they have more time to sew, and maybe others want to fix clothing that they have to save money.
And Belinda, Diane mentioned the creativity of sewing as something that appealed to her from the start. Talk about sewing as a creative outlet for people who may not think of it that way.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's such an easy way to start. So you really, you know, you can sew by hand. You don't need to have a machine. So it's something you can learn really easily. And then it's just so fun to be able to, you know, kind of think of an idea and then just be able to make it. I think, you know, you can also start from clothes that already exist and then add to them. So it's just like a really creative way to, you know, kind of be an individual and add things to your clothes. And, you know, I think a lot of, especially younger people, really kind of resonate with that and spend a lot of time doing it.
All right, Diane, here's a challenge for you, me. Since I was in elementary school, I have this magical thing where anything with scissors or drawing or cutting or anything like that, my fingers magically turn into thumbs. I can't do these things. Would there be hope for someone even as inept as me to learn how to sew and be able to do it and come out with something from it?
I think there would. I think you might have to have someone else cut out your patterns, but but I think you should be able to sew. A lot of the machines just about sew themselves these days. And I think that one of the things, just going back to what she mentioned as far as, you know, liking to make your own things, as far as Belinda mentioned, there's so much popularity now with the vintage and the thrift store clothing that I think that that's another thing that's brought people back to sewing clothing, because you can change, if you love the fabric of something, you can change the style features, or you can make it truly one of a kind by changing some of the techniques on the clothing.
And in doing some of those things, Belinda, do you see younger people taking interest in doing some of those projects, either making their own clothing or, as Diane was saying, taking that vintage stuff and making it fit?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I work with college students, and, you know, that generation specifically cares so much about like sustainability and reusing things and trying to reduce waste and things like that. And so I think that has been a big driver in like them wanting to sew more, because, you know, if a button falls off, they don't just have to get rid of it. They can sew it back on themselves, or, you know, they can buy something that has a hole in it and they can fix it instead of having to throw it away. So I think that's been like a huge thing specifically in that generation that has made them want to sew more.
Diane Dine is with us, worked a long time with the Sewing with Nancy team. She's been teaching this and judging it and everything, really. And Belinda Banicki from the Fashion Retail Program at UW-Stout. And with you, if you'd like, at 800-642-1234, call up with your sewing experiences and or questions. Let's go to your calls now. Lynn is with us in Stevens Point. Lynn, hi.
Hi. I'm calling from Stevens Point, Wisconsin, and I've been sewing since I was about four years old. I learned on a treadle that eventually became converted into a kick wheel for making pottery. And I just, this past winter, my sweetheart revived his mother's sewing machine. She had 7 kids that she sewed all their clothes. And he learned how to sew this winter, so he's excited about that. I mean, I'm proud of him for picking, because he couldn't even sew a button.
Oh, that's good news for me, Lynn. Are you working on projects together, or are you kind of just helping him along?
No, he's kind of slacked off now because he's pretty busy at work. But
okay.
I'm retired, so I'm just doing some mending. But I used to make a living doing, I'd worked in sweatshops, but then I moved on to doing custom work and more creative endeavors. So artists, because I'm a fiber artist as well. So it's just like this gal was just talking about repurposing. It's so nice to see the young kids that are getting into it, you know, and just it's such a meditate, you know, if you're not in a sweatshop situation, but in, you know, it's a meditation. It's just, you know, you're putting your thoughts on, it's like drawing. You're drawing with fabric.
Fantastic, Lynn. Thank you so much for sharing that. Well, Diane, for somebody like Lynn's sweetheart getting into it for the first time, if somebody out there is thinking they want to go from not sewing to sewing, how do you suggest they get started?
Well, I think the first thing is to make sure that you've got a machine that's running properly and that you read the manual and know how to use it. I think that's step number one. And then start with something simple to sew that doesn't involve any fitting. And I think just relax and have fun. I probably wouldn't have said this many years ago, but things don't have to be sewn perfectly, especially when you're sewing with young children, as I found out. Have good quality sewing supplies and use good quality fabric. I guess those are points that I would say are the best things for getting started.
And that's with a machine, Belinda. What if we wanted to work on some hand sewing as our first project, or is that a bad idea? I don't know.
I mean, I think it depends what you're doing and how good you want it to be. I mean, Diane's right. You know, having a really good machine is definitely your best bet. But there's so many resources out there, you know, online, and you can just, depending on what you want to do, you can find good resources for how to do it. So I just feel like if you want to do it, do it. You'll never know if you're good at it until you try it.
We've got two guests with us right now to talk about a growing interest in sewing. Belinda Banicki is the interim program director for the fashion and retail program at UW-Stout. She's got decades of sewing experience. And Diane Dine has taught sewing for decades and still continues to do that on a freelance basis. She also worked closely with the Sewing with Nancy team. And we want to hear from you. Do you sew? If so, what? And who got you into it and why do you do it? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We'd love to see a photo of a finished project or a work in progress. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the growing interest in sewing. We have two experienced sewing experts with us. Belinda Banicki is the interim program director for the fashion and retail program at UW-Stout. And Diane Dine is a former home economics teacher, has written many articles for Nancy's Notions, and worked closely with the Sewing with Nancy team. We want to hear from you. Have you been working on some sewing projects in the last few months? Why and how did you start sewing? What is a project you're proud of? Or maybe you have a really ambitious project that you want to tackle. Tell us all about it. Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. Let's go back to your calls now. Gail is with us in Superior. Gail, hello.
Hello. I think it's fabulous that everyone learns to sew, girls, boys, whatever. I'm from a family of, there was 10 kids in my family, and if I didn't learn to sew when I was in 4-H, when I was like in middle school, I didn't have things to wear. When I got married, I made my own wedding dress, attendance dresses, mother's dresses. I've moved on from there. I've done some quilts, pillowcases, you name it. Right now with the pandemic, I have made over 200 face masks that I just give away to family and stuff. But I'm also on the school board in my area, and I wish more kids would be doing this. And and have more summer programs that kids could learn to sew. And it's just something that gives me pleasure and an accomplishment. And I'm thankful I started back when I was in 4-H.
Gail, thanks a lot for that call. And Diane, would you like to see more exposure to sewing at early ages, whether from parents or in home ec classes or as you did in 4-H?
Definitely. I have a 3-year-old granddaughter and, well, actually she's older than that now. She started sewing when she was 3, but she's 5 now, and I have one that is 9 and one that is 8, and they all 3 of them sew, and they just really love it. So I think that it's good to expose them, you know, at a young age, and, you know, they make projects that they're proud of, and it makes them feel good. It makes me feel good for teaching them, and I think it's a win-win.
Will with us now in Platteville. Will, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I picked up sewing again for the first time in 25 years to help finish up some masks. But a lot of my friends have sewn for a long time, back in high school with Renaissance fairs. And more recently, I was an anime nerd, and many of my friends would do cosplay. And so many of them would make their own costumes or accessories, steampunk type stuff. And now I even see some of my students do it in classes.
Will, fantastic. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Belinda, do you see that? People interested in making costumes, whether it's for Renaissance fairs, cosplay, where people dress in costumes, or maybe with Halloween in mind.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a lot of students who come in and their, you know, kind of end career goal would be costume design, or, you know, they'll show us their portfolio and it's all filled with costumes and things like that. It's definitely a much more popular market than I would have expected. But like you said, I mean, for Halloween, you know, you can make your own costumes, which is always really popular. Again, you know, taking stuff that's from thrift stores and then kind of altering it to make your own costume. It's definitely a really, really popular thing, especially in the college age.
Will, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Talking about a renewed interest in sewing. Two experts with us, Belinda Banicki and Diane Dine. Still time for your questions and experiences. We heard from Bruce in Bayfield who called in to say, I have a sewing machine that was given to my parents at least 60 years ago. Where does one go to have a sewing machine checkup to get it in working order? Where would you point him toward, Diane?
Well, I would have him check, you know, local places that sell sewing machines, because many times they have someone there that fixes machines as well. Or look in your Yellow Pages or your Google it. You know, you can find a lot by Googling, and I think, you know, I found fabric stores and, you know, different for sewing machine parts and everything online. So, you know, you can definitely find them online or, you know, a lot of different avenues like that. But I would start with a reputable dealer.
And as I understand it, Belinda, Bruce should also have some patience. I understand during the pandemic, there are some pretty long waiting lists to get that old machine repaired. Have you seen that?
Yes, I have heard that too. I've had students who were trying to get machines for school that just started last week, and they're still kind of sold out everywhere. And, you know, I think everyone's at home. It's like a fun pastime to do. So, yeah, there's definitely a big backlog of machines at this point.
Let's go back to our callers. Samantha is with us in Whitehall. Samantha, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. When my grandma was alive, my dad's mom, we used to make quilts and how to put buttons on clothes and patches on pants and stuff. And I think that kids today need more of learning how to do that kind of stuff, because if you get a rip in your jeans and they're still good, you should be able to figure out how to put a patch on it and wear them. So that was my fondest memory.
And Samantha, are you still using these skills today?
Yes, I am. I live in a little apartment, so I don't have a sewing machine, but I do, you know, find myself putting a button on if a button falls off, or, you know, mending stuff, you know, just hand. But yes.
Samantha, thanks a lot for calling in. I'm looking down on my shirt here where I just lost a second button. I can't really wear it in public till I do something about that. Thanks a lot for that call, Samantha, and for sharing that. What would you say to someone, Diane, who maybe had those early lessons as a kid or used to do it and wants to get back into it? Easy as getting back on that bike?
Yes, I think so. Some of the techniques might have changed, but yeah, I think that if they pick up their machine, they look in their manual, and I think that they could start very easily.
Thanks a lot again for calling in, Samantha. Something I wanted to ask both of you about. Let's start with you, Belinda. Do you feel like there's a community of people who sew, whether it's the subgroups of quilters or costume makers or what have you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, kind of what you just said, quilting is such a big thing. There's quilting groups and things like that. I mean, I think, anytime you find something that you love doing, like, you want to talk about it with people. So, I think, especially with like creating and sewing and, there's always new techniques and new things you can do. And so being able to have like a community and a group of people who are into the same thing, it just helps you get better at it because they can kind of, teach you what they know and you can teach them what you know. And plus, it's fun to be proud of the things that you make and to kind of show them off and be around people who appreciate it.
And Diane, having been involved with the Sewing with Nancy team and owned a store, I'm going to go out on a limb and guess you've got some long-term friends you've made in the sewing community.
Oh, definitely. Nancy's Notions is not open anymore, but some of them have, still are doing Nancy's patterns, and she still has a website and whatever, so yes, I still am connected with them.
Fantastic. Well, just in our last couple minutes or so, tell me a good starter project, assuming we can get our hands on a good sewing machine and have it working. Diane, where would I start?
Well, it depends on the interest level. With my grandkids, they loved sewing on fleece. They made hats and scarves and things for their 18-inch dolls, and those were all fun for them. Some people might enjoy making pillows. Those are very easy to make. Embroidery or quilting, if you have an embroidery machine, the kids seem to like that too. Although one of my older granddaughters said, she was bored with embroidery because she said she didn't want to just sit and watch the machine do all the work. So while she would get the embroidery started, and then I would take her to the regular machine and she would, do some other sewing. So I think there's something for everyone. The pillows, pillowcases, some of the purse patterns are very easy, aprons, hats, scarves, that type of thing, or quilting.
All right. Well, and Belinda, give us a quick next step project before we let you go.
Yeah, I mean, she, kind of covered some of the really good ones. I would say anything that has like a lot of straight lines, is easy to follow. You don't have to do a lot of curves, things like that. That's where you start.
Well, it's been a lot of fun. Belinda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And Diane, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Diane Dine. She has designed and written many sewing-related books, patterns, and articles for Nancy's Notions and worked closely with the Sewing with Nancy team. She's taught sewing, owned and operated her own fabric store, and worked in the sewing industry for decades. We also heard from Belinda Banicki, the interim program director for the fashion and retail program at UW-Stout. She has also been sewing for decades. They were both with us to talk about a rise in popularity of sewing in the last decade, and especially during the pandemic. And you can keep the conversation going over on Twitter. What was the first thing you ever sewed? What's the most recent? If you used to do it and just restarted, what got you back into it? What gives you the most pleasure, making things for yourself or for others? And what is the one piece of advice you wish someone had given you when you were just starting out? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know, and we'd love to see photos of your creations, too. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, on this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll find out how to add some great Korean flavors to our home kitchens with the author of the Big Book of Korean Cooking. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. rose by any other name would smell as sweet. Shakespeare wrote that. So, okay, but what if that rose was actually a rotting fish? Some people couldn't really tell the difference. As reported in the Smithsonian Magazine, research published last month in the journal Current Biology finds that a small percentage of people can't detect the smell of rotting fish. It comes from a single gene mutation that detects a chemical that's a big part of the smell of decomposing fish. It's the chemical that also shows up in blood, bad breath, and other substances. Now, in this research, participants smelled good stuff, lemon, bananas, peppermint, such like, and also the bad fish. Most people, surprise, didn't like the bad fish smell. But the people with this gene mutation, the fish smelled either neutral or good. They identified the rotting fish as potatoes or caramel or even roses. I can see an up and downside here for people with this different gene. Upside, bad smells don't smell so bad. Downside, be real careful when you're cooking fish. Maybe get a second opinion to make sure it passes the smell test. This is Central Time.